Coming up on Life is a Festival.
The idea is that you have a thesis, an antithesis, and then you have a synthesis, right? And that these opposites, instead of having to pick one side or the other, you move beyond them. And the one example that he used, picking something little, existence itself. There's a, on one side you have being, and on the other side you have nothingness. But if you have just pure being, it's indistinguishable from nothingness. And the way they're synthesized is by becoming something concrete. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was thinking about that yesterday in terms of what's happening here when people are, artists are faced with these contradictions, this darkness and light, this beauty and horror, and this humor and sadness, all of these conflicts, they're all just ideas until they become something. And so I think that what's attractive and magnificent about this place that could be seen as just a derelict and forgotten place, it's become a place for becoming, for making things, and for making things out of these contradictions. And what emerges is delightful.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. So about a month ago, I went to the Bombay Beach Biennale. And the Bombay Beach Biennale is a renegade celebration of art, music, and philosophy that takes place, as they say, on the literal edge of Western civilization, which is the shores of the Salton Sea. This kind of derelict post-apocalyptic seaside town turns into this extravagant art happening. So just on a few hours of sleep, co-founder Tao Raspoli and I sat down at the Biennale itself for a conversation about philosophy and the irresolvable contradictions of art, which was pretty heady for a couple hours of sleep, but I feel like we did well, and I think you'll enjoy it. On the show, we discuss the ecological and philosophical paradox of the Salton Sea and the strange fate of Bombay Beach itself. Tao shares why great art is made in inhospitable environments a la Burning Man and Bombay Beach. We talk about this year's theme, questioning hierarchy and what it means to question hierarchy. And then we invite festival producer Dulcinea Daguerre up to the stage to talk about the art of facilitation and neuroscientist Dr. Patrick House, who had been showcasing a human brain just earlier that morning, who talks about anticipatory nostalgia. It's a heady show, folks, in a heady place. Finally, Tao shares his vision for life as a festival and why the existence of death is what makes meaning possible. That seems to have become kind of a theme for the show. So Tao Raspoli is an Italian-American filmmaker. He's a photographer, a musician, an accomplished flamenco guitarist, actually, and co-founder of the Bombay Beach Biennale. His films include Fix, Being in the World, and the 2017 exploration of polyamory, Monogamish. Founded in 2015, the Bombay Beach Biennale transforms abandoned housing, vacant lots, and decaying shoreline into a unique canvas for creative expression. Artists, philosophers, creators, and makers across many mediums donate their time and talents to the volunteer-led happening. So listen in, my friends, as Tao and I, live from the Biennale itself, discuss how Bombay Beach became a place for becoming. I hope you enjoy it. So my name is Eamon Armstrong, and I host a podcast called Life is a Festival. Now, I'm aware that this is not a festival, but we'll see. I like to argue that things are festivals that other people say that they're not, like Burning Man and Bombay Beach, not Biennale weekend. But I host a podcast called Life is a Festival. So one half of this is that. Tao also hosts a podcast, and if he deems this worthy, it will appear on his as well.
Yes.
What's your podcast?
Being in the World, which I often co-host with one of our audience members here named Dr. Patrick House, who was one of our illustrious speakers. And he spoke to about 100 people earlier, and Dulcinea went around like a old-fashioned 1960s flight attendant, but serving the opportunity to hold a human brain. And it was quite an experience.
So you had like a 10 a.m. brain holding ritual?
Yeah. I don't think I would call it a ritual, but yeah. it was a happening.
But you don't get to hold the physical brain.
Yes,
you can squish it. Did people have to like wash their hands before?
They had to wear gloves.
Okay.
And it was preserved in formaldehyde.
Yeah. Otherwise, you'd need to wash the brain afterwards.
Would you? I don't know.
Patrick has done his brain job at this moment. So your podcast is Being in the World?
Yes.
Is that based on the 2010 documentary by the same name?
Sort of. Only insofar as that documentary is based on Being in the World.
Okay. And that's like a Heidegger reference?
It is.
Do you want to do Heidegger really quick? Just like get people up to speed? Come on, it's a Saturday. Does anyone in the audience not know who Martin Heidegger was?
Okay, Martin Heidegger was arguably one of the two or three most important philosophers of the 20th century.
Arguably.
Also, on the flip side...
The theme is non-hierarchy here, or questioning hierarchy. So yes, let's question that hierarchy, that what deems one a great philosopher. Let's say amongst the academic, philosophical class that we should deconstruct in any way that we can, or also just reinterpret the way we're doing here, he is... been deemed an important philosopher. And I happened to find him very interesting when I was studying philosophy. And more so, the professor who taught him and brought him to kind of an American audience, and a guy named Hubert Dreyfus, who was like my mentor at Berkeley when I studied philosophy, he brought this very, at the time, obscure and difficult German philosopher to an American analytic philosophy audience. And he was interested in using his thoughts on critiquing the attempt at making artificial intelligence. And it was really interesting. He thought that the problem was with this whole project at MIT, where they were like starting this idea of making artificially intelligent machines, is that they assumed that human beings were like computers. And we always think that we are like whatever the last clever invention we came up with is, and everything is that. So like the whole universe was like a steam engine, and human beings were like steam engines when steam engines were the latest things that we'd come up with. And then when the computer was invented, they say, oh, the human brain must be a computer, and the brain is hardware, and we're running some sort of software, and it'll just be a few years before we can program our new really clever machines to do the same things as human beings do. And Dreyfus's genius was taking Heidegger's philosophy and saying, your project is bound to fail because you have a wrong understanding of what it means to be human. And what it means to be human is not being a calculating machine that thinks objectively about the world, but that you are always already in the world. You're immersed in it, and we can't separate what it is to be a self from what it is to be part of a community, what it is to be skilled in a certain domain, whether that's music or conversation, language. Anyway, I could go on. Cut me off anytime.
This is Tao on 3 hours of sleep, by the way. So, didn't Heidegger get canceled, though, speaking of hierarchies? Was he canceled? I mean,
yes.
Yeah, he's a Nazi, right?
He deserved to be canceled for his politics, which were hideous. And he was an opportunist and just not a very good human from everything I understand. And it brings up a very interesting question is, can you be a great philosopher and a terrible human? Can you be a great artist and a terrible human? I think the answer is yes, but I think it's a difficult question.
Well, let's see how terrible of humans we can be in the next, 90 minutes. I challenge you to be as terrible as you can. Okay, so philosophy, being in the world, art... kind of like orbiting around what I was hoping to discuss with you today. This is my first time at the Biennale, which is no longer a Biennale weekend, which is itself a kind of shifting of hierarchy. We can talk about that. But I think that a good place to locate our audience, particularly those who are in this place for the first time, is this actual place.
Yeah.
Bombay Beach. So fascinating. I mean, we're below sea level. This is the lowest community in the United States. This
is in the Western Hemisphere.
In the Western Hemisphere, the lowest community. It was not a lake before 1903. And then it became a lake because they diverted the Colorado River, and then it became not a lake. And
it actually became a sea. I learned this recently. I thought it was a joke calling it the Salton Sea, but actually it's a sea. It's salty and it doesn't have inlets. Or, no, it has an inlet, but it has no outlets.
And that's what makes it salty, right? Because it's constantly evaporating.
Exactly.
So what happened in the 80s that fucked it up? Because for a while it was like a seaside town, like Frank Sinatra had a home here. There was the whole thing.
So what happened was they were bringing water using the Colorado River as, this is another controversial topic, but as most people should know, and I'm sure you do, that most of the water from that Californians drink comes from the Colorado River. None of the Colorado River ends up in the ocean, not one drop. Every drop is spoken for and divvied up between farms and humans from the source. And so in 1903, they were damming the Colorado River, directing it to fulfill Southern California's water needs. And there was a breach in a dam. And for 2 years, they could not control the entire contents of the Colorado River were flooding into this low basin, which had water in it. It's had water in it over the eons. But this time, it was because of a man-made mistake. And so they say it's the only accident you can see from space. And so you get this giant puddle, which turns into the largest body of water in California. Inland body of water, obviously the ocean's bigger, but it's vast. And most people don't even know that it exists. I grew up in Los Angeles and had no idea that this thing was here. And when I saw on a book that there's this thing called the Salton Sea and it's deteriorating in a really interesting way, I came over here and started to learn more about it. And again, that's something I could just talk on and on about. So
it's okay. I'll be responsible for cutting you. That's my literal only job in this situation.
Oh, so I will finish the story of what happened was this giant puddle emerges in the desert, like 30, 40 miles long and 10 miles wide. And a bunch of very optimistic, if we're going to be charitable or opportunistic humans said, oh, what could possibly go wrong? That we have a giant sea in the middle of the desert and we could have Palm Springs, but with fishing and boating and fresh water. And they built all these towns around and started selling this miracle in the desert, they called it. And they made a yacht club and there was marinas and there was a period of a few decades where it actually was okay because they would like keep it full with all the runoff from the agriculture. All the farms around here, like half the produce of the United States is grown in this Imperial Valley. And
today it is?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, if you drive here, it's the middle of the desert, but when you bring this Colorado River water to this desert, you get this very fertile ground. And that's actually one of the things that went wrong is that people think of the sea as dead, but it's the opposite. It started breeding all this life and the life started competing. So there's like the fish multiplied by the tens of millions and there was algal blooms and it just became this really, really like intense petri dish of life competing and then death because like the fish started dying and washing up on shore. And then in the 90s, you had days where like 9 million fish once in one day died because the mixture of the heat, the algae, and the salt, freshwater fish trying to adapt to salt water, and the smell became unbearable. And the people started to abandon the towns, except a few eccentrics who stayed. And then a few eccentrics who arrived in the last few years.
So speaking of eccentrics who arrived, when did you discover and fall in love with this place?
In 2008, I saw this book by Kim Stringfellow, which was like had this rotting Airstream trailer in a puddle of like toxic orange liquid. And it looked like this kind of underbelly of something I was very interested in, kind of desert life and modernist design and the whole Palm Springs modernist aesthetic I always found very appealing and the Airstream kind of nomadic side of American living. And then to see this kind of decay of that, I was immediately enthralled by this idea. And I got in my car and I drove here and I circled the whole sea. And also as a photographer, it was interesting. And filmmaker, so it's very visually exciting and peculiar and interesting. And so, you get to the eastern shore, and then you pass North Shore, which has remnants of Hawaii and is nothing like Hawaii. It's about as different from Hawaii as you could possibly be. And then it says, "Welcome to Mecca," and you're like, "What's this? Why is this place called Mecca?" And you're in this distinctly American landscape, and yet they have these foreign names. and you start feeling like you're in a dream, and you have just vast open desert on the left and this huge body of water that's very still, mysteriously still on the right. And then you think that's it. You're just going to see desert and water. And then it says Bombay Beach, 8 miles. And why is it called Bombay Beach? I have no idea. And so you pull up to this perfect little square grid of five streets by five streets named A, B, C, D, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as if we're in New York City. And this massive 300-foot-tall cell tower and 1,000 lots, 90% of which are abandoned and falling apart, and 10% of them who have really cool, interesting people living in them. And I could not believe that I had never heard of this place or I had never been here. So and there's one bar called the Ski Inn, which makes no sense until you realize that people used to water ski up to it. And so I started hanging out at the Ski Inn and bringing all my friends here. And I was married at the time. And I said to my wife, I'm like, let's buy a house in Bombay Beach. And she said, are you fucking crazy? Why would anyone want to buy a house in that place? Like, people thought of it as a horrible place. And I thought of it as a wonderful place. And so I got divorced in 2010. And the first thing I did is buy a house here. And maybe like a week later. And then I started bringing more and more friends here. And had this idea to my dear friend who's here, Mark Rathall. He's a professor at Oxford in philosophy, and he was a Dreyfus student as well. And I said, what would it take to do a philosophy conference in Bombay Beach? And he also looked at me like I was crazy, but he humored me and he said, well, it doesn't take much because philosophers love to talk. And so you just invite them and they'll come. And and then I ran into an old friend that I'd known since the seventh grade named Stefan Ashkenazi, and he owns the Petit Hermitage Hotel, and he's very good at creating spectacle and amazing experiences and like culinary experiences and group gatherings of all kinds. And he's into the kind of, I call him a ringleader in the circus of life. He just loves like extremes and surrealness. And it turns out that he had been thinking of doing a sort of art festival in the high desert. And his girlfriend at the time had been telling him about Bombay Beach. And I started telling him about Bombay Beach. And we came down here one Thanksgiving. And he said the idea shifted from communing with nature to commiserating with it. Mm. And so me and Stefan and a third partner, Lily, started the Bombay Beach Biennale with the idea of bringing philosophy and art and great experiences of all kinds, whether it's music or culinary experiences, all the last things in the world you would expect to see here, ballet, opera, the Oxford philosophy professors, just gatherings of writers and thinkers and creators and podcasters, and see what happens. And what happened was way beyond my wildest dreams. And this is where we are now.
So Tal, I've heard you say that this started as a joke. Is it still funny?
So to me, the most interesting thing about Bombay Beach and this whole scene here, both before and after we got here, is that there are these irresolvable contradictions that manifest themselves the moment you arrive here. You're in the desert, and yet it's this giant body of water. So is it wet or is it dry? You don't know, right? You're in this open space, and yet, like I said, you're in this little contained square of force, you know, in this perfect geometry. And then it's very orderly, but then you arrive and it's chaos, more chaos than I've ever seen anywhere except maybe Port-au-Prince. Like, that's the level of like disrepair that this had fallen into when I arrived here. Now it's gotten, you know, a little less so, but it's still quite starkly different from what you usually see when you turn off a highway in this country. No corporations, no restaurants, no Denny's, no gas stations. The nearest gas station is like 25 miles away. People go around in golf carts because they can't get gas. You have all these contradictions. And this was an answer to your question, but I don't remember what the question was.
Question was, is the joke still funny?
Is the joke still funny? So you have also this kind of absurdity and humor, like the name Bombay Beach, and there's like a certain quirkiness. There's a great documentary called The Plagues and Pleasures of the Salton Sea that John Waters narrates. And there's no doubt that there's a funniness to this place. But that coexists in this weird tension with something that's not funny at all, which is like economic and environmental catastrophe, worse than you've ever seen, I think. Like maybe Detroit. I mean, there's just like, you know, it's serious. So the question is, can you engage with a serious situation with humor, with playfulness? That's a question we're asking, and I don't know the answer to it. I hope so, somehow.
So I appreciate bringing Kim Stringfellow's book into the conversation. I know that that's been influential for you. And there's something from his book that I will reference because you said you're not sure where the name came from. What I have here is that some people say that the name came from bombers doing target practice over the Chocolate Mountains, and they would open their bomb bay doors over Bombay.
And they were doing practice runs for the Fat Man, the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. There's still dummy bombs in the sea. They would keep, they had to have the right weight of the ballast. So they fill it with depleted uranium. And so there's like dummy bombs full of depleted uranium in the, you know, sitting there. And just like, supposedly they had like 10 plane crashes. And, you know, when a soldier dies at sea, you leave it there. So there's like World War II soldiers that are still, their remains are in planes. And this is all about to be revealed. And
about to be revealed?
Yeah, because the sea is dehydrating up now. Because the water that was being used to fill the sea in 2017 with a water deal with San Diego, the water is being diverted. So they used to put 1 million acre feet a year into the sea to keep it at levels, often too high, and Bombay Beach itself would flood, and that's why it's so fucked in this Lower East Side too. And there's this berm around the town. So we have this amazing view, another contradiction. This like beautiful view, but we can't see it because like we're like underneath it. And then so there's these, so now the sea is drying up because they're not, it's not going to completely dry up. And a lot of people I still talk to today in LA were like, oh, isn't that a dry sea? Like they think it's just like a dry lake bed. They don't realize that there's still vast amounts of water in there. And it's not going to completely dry up. It's just they're putting 500,000 acre feet instead of 1 million acre feet in a year. So the shoreline is receding, which is a blessing in disguise for us here in Bombay Beach, because now we've got this giant playa out front and no more smell of dead fish. So the fact that all the fish died makes it not smell bad anymore. So it's like this terrible thing, but this wonderful thing. And everywhere you look, it's just these contradictions. Terrible and wonderful, sad and funny. It's historic. It's got ruins as if we were like in ancient Rome, but it's also so new, a very American, like Western pioneer place. So you have to just learn to live with the contradictions. And I think the reason this has become so successful is that philosophers, thinkers, writers, artists of all stripes are, when faced with contradiction, they don't try and resolve it or pick a side. They synthesize it into the work that they do. And that's why if you want to see how these contradictions manifest and what their synthesis is, just look at all this new work that's emerged in the last 7 years that we've been doing this.
So this is kind of along the same thread. You talked about how you're getting a playa here because of the evaporation. So another big space for innovative art is Burning Man. And a similarity with Burning Man is this thing where art is flourishing in inhospitable environments. So the harder it is to make the art, it seems that the art is somehow better in those spaces or more interesting or dynamic, or people are willing to put more effort into it. What is it about inhospitable environments that brings artists to create in your mind?
Well, first of all, yeah, contrasting it with the gallery world, the white cubes and the Hauser and Wirths and all of these elite commodified art scenes that are just basically ways to launder money. It's like art is great when it's living and it's like a reaction to what it is to be human at that time, right? And in that place, not when it's like in a museum. And it's interesting when it's in a museum because it gives you a hint of what it was to be human in times past. But it's, you have a very different relationship to the work when it's something that's an interpretation of what it is to be in that place and in that time and in that specificity. So I think there's not a coincidence that when you go to these highway exits that are all the same in the rest of the country and you get to Denny's and your Chevron and your giant parking lots and Walmarts, that there is no art or creativity of any kind, because I think there's art both subtly and explicitly designed to dull the senses and to dull creativity. And so when you come to a place like this, one of the other reasons I think artists are attracted to it is that despite all the sadness, despite all of the tragedy and the mismanagement and all the disasters that have happened here, when an artist is confronted with something new and unique, our senses are heightened. And suddenly we get this thing called inspiration and work starts to come out. So that's why I think, and that's why Burning Man, and the dialogue with Burning Man is interesting because like I was very pleased. I love Burning Man. I'd been going since 2001, but I also thought, I felt like it's gotten a little bit too big for its own good. It had its heyday and kind of I want to be careful with my words because I have huge admiration for what they've done on many levels. But at the same time, it feels like it had climaxed and gone to somewhere else. That someone said anarchism doesn't scale. So like, it's just when you get that big, it just becomes a different type of beast, right? So I was really happy when both the Burning Man founders showed up here at the first festivals that we did and were proud of us and were really happy with, they reminded them of early Burning Man, they said. But at the same time, when the New York Times wrote about it, they called it the anti-Burning Man. Because Burning Man's whole thing is like, let's go into this blank canvas and make something and then just have a great time and then like have it disappear like a mandala. And there's a beauty and a symbolism to that that I appreciate. But our mission is the opposite. It's like leave a trace and use the art in a meaningful way in a community that exists and in dialogue with a place that already was there. So it has a history and it has like a context that I think Burning Man lacks that sometimes makes the art come across as a little more frivolous.
So Bombay Beach has the quality of a ghost town. There's a ghost town vibe to this place.
That's another contradiction. It looks abandoned and there's hundreds of people who live here.
So looking at Bombay Beach through the lens of a ghost town, you lost a dear friend and collaborator this year, this community did. And I'd like to take a moment to bring him into the space. I know that a part of this Biennale has been about honoring him. And I think that when we're talking about the contradictions of this kind of ghost town that's alive, this art that is permanent, this permanence and impermanence, I just wanted to give you a moment in this conversation to just bring him into the space to offer whatever you'd like to offer.
Yeah, this is a very sensitive topic for me. And so, and also on 3 hours of sleep, one's emotions are more fragile even. And we've been living this now, like memorializing him for the first time since he died. So forgive me if I choke up. One of the great artists that was drawn to this place, his name was Shig, Steve Shigley, but he went by Shig. And I met him in the high desert and I brought him down here and immediately realized that there was a match made in heaven or made in hell, I don't know. But there was a match between this human and this place. And so we started having ideas together about things to make here. And I was always pushing limits of like size. So he was making that kind of, you know, 6 foot tall metal sculptures. And then I said, why don't we make a 4-dimensional cube, a tesseract that's 20 feet tall. And he's like, well, let's make it 10 feet tall. And I'm like, oh, let's make it 20 feet tall. And we'd like go back and forth. And then he'd come back and say, okay, I figured out how to make it 20 feet tall. Let's do it. And I would get people excited and try and bring money for materials to him. And so we built this like maybe the world's largest tesseract. We haven't found a bigger one. And that was also a joke on the fact that the, you know, there's the square of Bombay Beach, this weird geometry and rigidity to it. And then there's, you know, you take a square and you go another dimension out, you get a cube. And then his White Cube is the famous art gallery. So I said, well, how do we go one dimension beyond White Cube? So you get the tesseract is a 4-dimensional cube. And just how you can draw a 3-dimensional cube on a piece of paper in 2 dimensions, you can draw a 4-dimensional cube in 3 dimensions and you can see the projection of it basically. So if you, when you see a drawing of a cube on a piece of paper, you're seeing the projection of it, like as if a light is going through it. So we built this giant tesseract and then the next year we built a lighthouse. Well, another absurd, wonderful thing, the idea of having a lighthouse with boats that would need it to arrive in Bombay Beach. And then he's moved down here and I gave him a place to stay back here. And he started making piece after piece. And if you go out to the beach, there's this SOS sign, which he said stood for Save RC. But given what happened next, we realized that it had much more layered meaning than that. And then there was steps that he made that will go out into the sea in this very mystical, beautiful way. When the sea is perfectly still, you walk out there and they reflect in the water. And there's this kind of deep irony that he made these pieces that are, if there's one thing that defined them, it's like a stillness and a timelessness. And yet he was not still at all. He was very uncomfortable in his own skin, very speedy, very always running around, nervous, very nervous energy, and full of passion and full of fire and always making giant fires and pissed off at everybody and moody and just intense fucker. Like, just like everyone who knew him got an impression, you know? And I, like I said, the elements here, there's a playfulness, but there's also a brutality here, a brutality of nature, a brutality of what human beings have done to each other, an injustice of the kind of inequality that you see manifest here. And all that came to a head in COVID And he hadn't seen his daughter in 2 years because COVID didn't allow travel. And so he shot himself here in the backyard. And so we're here honoring him and his work this weekend.
Why don't we take just a moment for that? It was really beautiful as a guest in this place, the procession to go and see his pieces, holding candles, spilling wax all over my fingers like a dummy, but like walking around and like seeing these different pieces together. And it was really beautiful. There's a woman who had a deep love for him that we together were experiencing her grief in a very expressive way, which had its own, in a sense, kind of artistic quality to it. Like the quality of presence that is like true emotional expression that has the quality of great art as well. And so the experience of seeing, and I'd never met this man, but seeing his work and experiencing the community grieving was a really powerful, powerful experience as a guest in this place.
Yeah.
It felt quite an honor to be able to be
and
here.
And it was catharsis through ritual, right? Yeah. And we hadn't had that. We hadn't had any closure. And, you know, this happened last summer and he hadn't had a funeral or anything.
When I think that brings us into, you know, even more into the conversation of the meaning of art. Like, why? Why do any of this? Why create anything? Yeah. And for you personally, I mean, you're a philosopher, you're a documentary filmmaker, which is a lot about capturing stories and presenting things for others. We're talking about things like the timeless quality of art. But we know, in part, we know because of this place, that there's no timeless anything. Time eats everything. Time will eat this lake. Eventually, no matter what, they're going to stop putting the water in it and time will eat this lake.
I've been thinking and reading about dialectical thinking.
Okay, let's do it.
And that's the idea of like thinking of embracing dialogue first, like it came from Socrates and the idea of dialogue, but then it was reinvigorated a few thousand years later by Hegel. And he talked about, I was thinking about in terms of these contradictions that we've been discussing, right? Like the idea is that you have a thesis, an antithesis, and then you have a synthesis, right? And that these opposites, instead of having to pick one side or the other, you move beyond them. And the one example that he used, picking something little, existence itself. there's on one side you have being, and on the other side you have nothingness. But if you have just pure being, it's indistinguishable from nothingness. And the way they're synthesized is by becoming something concrete. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was thinking about that yesterday in terms of what's happening here when people are, artists are faced with these contradictions, this darkness and light, this beauty and horror, and this humor and sadness, all of these conflicts, they're all just ideas until they become something. And so I think that what's attractive and magnificent about this place that could be seen as just a derelict and forgotten place, it's become a place for becoming, for making things, and for making things out of these contradictions. And what emerges is delightful. Like there's like a cow on the roof across the street. And like Mark Mack, who's like, was a guy, an amazing man I made friends with like 20 years ago. He was an architect, very illustrious architect, has built buildings all over the world. He was a professor at Berkeley, he was a professor at UCLA. But he's like this little, very eccentric, very anarchistic, obviously, his disposition is clearly disposed to anarchy. And when he saw what we were doing here, he's like, I want to come and see. And he buys a place and he built this museum of unwanted architecture where you could like feature works that had been rejected for all sorts of reasons, mundane reasons that are frustrating to artists, right? When their work gets rejected. And he made the house inside out in a way that you could never do anywhere else. Like the roof is like an M instead of like a, you know, instead of pointing upwards, it points downward. And obviously if it snowed or rained, this would never work, but it's like this dry environment, so you can do this. And then he uses inside materials outside, and the garage door opens inside out towards the outside, and he has AstroTurf in his bedroom and wallpaper on the outside. And
does he live there full time?
He comes back and forth like a lot of us do.
So he lives so he lives in this peculiar place.
Yeah. And it's so the other thing that we've tried to do is blur the line between public and private space. So the one of the problems with contemporary American life, and Marcus talks eloquently about this, is that there is no public space. I mean, when you think about in Europe, you sit in a piazza and you gather with your friends and have a drink. And here you have all this space and it's all taken up by giant parking lots where you can't be with each other. And I don't think that's an accident. I think that this corporate way of organizing things, which is very hierarchical, is designed to stop people from expressing these contradictions. And it's like designed to make people conform in very subtle ways. And so that's why I think this place is so special.
So Tao, you clearly do not care for hierarchy. In fact, the theme is question hierarchy. So maybe it's not that you don't care for hierarchy. Maybe you're down with hierarchy as long as it's questioned. Let's talk about your relationship to hierarchy and this place's relationship to hierarchy. Because the idea that the theme of a not biennale, the non-weekend that we're here for, is that we're questioning hierarchy. Obviously, someone needs to facilitate all that questioning. And how can you have a flat society? Is that my job? I'm the questioner?
You're questioning.
How can we have a flat society if there isn't someone to, you know, police that we're in some sort of flat arrangement? So what are we doing here in terms of questioning hierarchy? And so far, halfway through the weekend, have we come up with any answers?
Well, again, it's not the weekend anymore. Like, this is a
sorry,
movement.
Pardon me, the non-weekend that we're not here.
The weekend is a culmination of a season. And the idea is to have a Biennale season every year, and where artists gather here for a meaningful amount of time and like foster community with each other, with the people who are here before us, with new people who are coming. And we don't want it to be a party. We can have a party. That's what we're having this weekend. But the party it has an important context, which is the celebration of us all having been here for 3 months doing all this. You know, there's an irony that people talk about America as a free country when it's, I think, one of the least free places that I've ever been. And for the reasons we discussed, there's explicit kind of authoritarianism and forms of police that I'm sure Chloe will talk about in her talk. But there's also these much more subtle and even more nefarious ways of like making people conform. There's explicit and implicit authority present everywhere that you go in America. And I think the other thing that makes this place so attractive to someone like any of us here is that there's not much authority here. And like, it's not a town. It's a census designated place. So there's no mayor. There's no police station. There's a city council, but they don't have any power. They can just suggest. And if you study anarchist political philosophy, there's this idea, you know, some people think of anarchism as like being bomb throwing and like just disregard for the structures of civilization. It's not that. It's a very deeply idealistic philosophy that says if you let people be without imposed authority, they'll flourish, not like misbehave. Or if they misbehave, it'll be in a way that's fruitful, right? And so I think that, like I said, the ground is very fertile here for all the produce that's grown in the United States. All you have to do is add water and to the desert and you get this. And I think that if you just add artists, you get a different type of fertility. You get like really interesting stuff growing.
Okay, so for the sake of actually organizing events and doing things, I know that there's a lot of work that goes into it. And so when we're talking about hierarchy and organization, I mean, we're on a schedule. We're here in a place at a time. Then there are people here with us. So they obviously knew we were here. Is that hierarchy or is that is there another word for it? Because it's not quite self-organizing, right? Dulcinea is mouthing that there's a lot of work that goes into it. No. What is she mouthing?
Facilitation, exactly.
So Dulcinea says facilitation.
And there's something called heterarchy that I learned about recently, which is like, because hierarchy implies that there is one hierarch. There's one person in charge, and then there's, you know, it's like a pyramid shape, right? There's one person, then that person might have a few people below him or her, and then on and on like this. And that rigidity is the opposite of questioning, right? Like it's there and it assumes that the way things have been done is the way they should continue to be done, because you don't question the authority, right? You're not allowed to. You know, the way like a corporate structure is set up is not so that people can like play with the conventions of how things are done. No, it's been figured out. This is what's most efficient. This is how we're going to make the most money. Everything else be damned, right? Now, there is an efficiency to hierarchy. And I think that that's what you hinted at a minute ago. And I remember when I was a kid, a teenager, I got enthralled with Salvador Dali, as many teenagers do, right? And he was friends with my father, and my dad had recordings of them chatting. And he had very reactionary politics. He was very right-wing, and which is very unusual for artists. And he said the reason is because hierarchy is the most important thing. And the universe is hierarchical, and nature is hierarchical, and the artist's job is to distinguish the good from the bad and to become good at technique. And of course, his technique was impeccable. And he said, you should never worry about being too perfect in your painting because you'll never achieve that perfection. So this kind of Platonic ideal of striving for something higher and better. But I think in the end, people who seriously think about art don't take his art very seriously. It's very superficially appealing. And I think that that's the same thing with these hierarchies that like are very efficient when it comes to like, yes, Walmart makes a lot of money and you can get whatever you want there, but it sucks, right? And so it sucks so much more than going to any shop, right? That's like, or even no shop as we have here in Bombay Beach. So that's why we have to ask the question. But the question is a serious one. Like, I don't think you should just disregard hierarchy. I have a friend who I'm always arguing about this, who's more anarchist than me. And he said, we should call it beyond hierarchy. And I was like, no, because that's like assumes the answer, that you've already figured out that non-hierarchy is better. But I think it's a question that grappling with it is more interesting than answering it. And grappling with it and questioning is intrinsically valuable. Right? Just asking the question is in and of itself a worthwhile pursuit, I think, even if you don't come up with an answer.
That reminds me of the great Rilke quote, to love the questions themselves and live your way into an answer. Yeah. And I find that very comforting because I don't know anything.
Exactly. Yeah, and to think you know is the how you stop
that's
learning
the trap.
Anything.
That's the trap. You have done a lot in your life and you have a lot of impact where you go and what you do. And you've had a lot of impact in this place, like in the way that you have collaborated, in the way that you have brought your own ideas, but also synthesized ideas with other people. There's been a lot of action from you to this place. And I'm curious, how are you distinctly different as a being because of your encounter with this place?
Oh, hugely so. I find it's changed me more than I've changed it. Like any change that I've put into it, it's like thanks to like a massive community of incredible coincidences. And there's been a perfect blend of happy accidents and deliberate kind of gentle pushing into certain directions. But I'd say this is like an accidentally life-defining project. Like I thought it was just a side thing that, like I said, like a kind of surreal, playful, temporary thing. And it is all those things still. But it became so much more than I ever expected it to. And it's just like very moving for me to see all these people gathering here and like engaging with this. I mean, literally, you could have a lot of land for sale here when I got here that had been on the market for 10 years. And nobody wanted it. Like there was like $500 for a lot of land. And I would bring people here. Now, mind you, the smell was worse. And there was in the John Waters documentary, there's like this woman, like little old lady talking in this very deadpan voice. And she's like, we have the problem of the heat and we have the insect problem, namely the house fly, and there's like flies landing on her. And she's like, and then there's the fact that we don't have anything here. And it's just like... And there was a long time of bringing people here and like thinking like, this is just my peculiar eccentricity to like think that this is interesting. And it's just been so amazing to see all these people come here and realize that this is a project like worth dedicating one's life to. And that even in this very specific place, we're having an impact on it. And it's being talked about all over the world. And it's been covered by huge media. Not that that matters, but it's just interesting that they're paying attention. Like, I feel like there's a kind of electricity coming from here. And every time we're here, it has a ripple effect. And just, you know, I don't want to romanticize it either. It's we have conflict and we have tragedy and we have people who hate what's happening here. And, you know, one of the other contradictions is that this is a community, but it's also a bunch of really fucking individual and very specific characters who maybe came here not to be around other people. maybe they liked that there was nobody here. And that's respect. Like, I don't want to impose. It's like a delicate dance with how do we like engage with the place and provoke, because you also don't want to make like milk toast art. You want to make art that's provocative, but then that's going to piss people off. So I don't know what the answer to that is, but I'm really loving the dialogue, and I'm loving, like, as far as it becoming my identity, it's, you know, I always thought of myself as a filmmaker, and that was great, and I love making movies, and there's a great space for that. But this, in a way, is more tailored to what I love, which is like being in real life with people and making three-dimensional things and spaces and experiences for people, and then film can be a part of that.
You really love the artists here. That's one thing that has been really clear to me. And when we were first conceptualizing this conversation, the thing that seemed most important to you was that we don't spend the whole time talking to you about your ideas and your vision and your experience here. And you're like, I just want to bring in some of the artists, some of my friends. I want to create some space to share the community of this place. So it's a Saturday on a big weekend, so I'm not sure how many of the people that you had in mind of the friends.
I think Dulcinea should
up.
Come in here, because she's the one who's been working like crazy to help make this happen. And the irony is that she had never been to the Biennale before. It spent a lot of time here. But what she brought to this with both fresh eyes and a work ethic that I just have no familiarity with, not in myself and not even in anyone else I've ever seen such level of focus. And insofar as like anarchism is possible, it does require like gentle structuring. And she's made this happen, and it would have been impossible because I also lost my co-founders this year. Like, Stefan, was a bad year for hotels with COVID and has other concerns, and Lily's in Switzerland, left the country. So it was just been, insofar as there's been any hierarchy, again, malleable, questioned hierarchy, it's been thanks to this person. So I think she should come up
here. Dulcinea, would you like to come on up? Hi, Dulcinea.
Hi, Eamon.
Nice to see you. Dulcinea.
Nice to see you.
Dulcinea, rock star. I was texting you about where the hell I was supposed to be like 30 minutes ago while you're dealing with everybody. I'm probably like one of 30 people who've been texting you. Be like,
it's true.
So you were in the audience and you shouted out facilitation when we talked about hierarchy. So as someone who seems to be like the prime facilitator of this experience, someone who has never been to this event before and hasn't necessarily done like a ton of large event production, I'd love to hear about what facilitation means for you and perhaps what you've learned about facilitation in your gargantuan task of bringing all of these individual confrontational artists together.
Yes, what a question. Also operating on 3 hours of sleep, so let that be a disclaimer. Facilitation is, what did you say, a gentle structure. So I've been thinking a lot about systems that are efficient, that help people get the things that they need. This is almost entirely volunteer run. And so people need things, and there are people who want to help them. How do you connect those people together in a way that isn't blowing up the group chat every second? I mean, that works, but I'm already thinking about a system of like how to connect people who have needs to people who are ready and willing to give their time and their labor. The first thing I tried to do, and I think worked pretty well, though people really hate filling out forms. I don't know why. I think forms are like really easy to fill out. But about 2 months ago, we made a series of forms for people who wanted to contribute to the Biennale. And so those forms were venue forms, artist forms, and volunteer forms.
Did I fill out a form?
No, you didn't. It's okay. If you're my friend, you like don't have to fill out a form.
That sounds a bit like hierarchy.
It sounds a bit like friendship, okay? It sounds a bit like fucking friendship. No, because part of the job of the facilitator is also to meet the people where they're at, right? Like, and so there are a lot of people who didn't want to fill out forms. And I would just calmly and kindly say, look, If you don't want to fill out a form, you can come to office hours. So for the past week, I have been sitting here at the Institute with my computer at 10 a.m. and say, if you're feeling such a way about a form, come sit with me or call me. Like, it's not like, oh, if you don't fill out the form, you're not allowed to participate. And so I think there's flexibility. It's like Maisha was talking about this concept of solidarity care and how we need to communicate about the ways that we want to be taken care of to the people around us so that they can show up for us in the way that we need to be cared for. And so it's like I can present a structure that I think in my weird little brain might help us do something together. And then we learn from that. We learn if it works or not. Like, again, with the volunteers thing, like, I haven't cracked the volunteer code yet of, like, how do we more efficiently manage all of these needs and all of the labor in a way that makes sense and people aren't looking for trash bags for 2 hours, you know? And so I think the forms really worked in the sense of getting everybody, all of the random beautiful people who wanted to contribute to the Biennale in a very non-hierarchical way. I mean, friends, but also literally random people just filling out a form and saying, I want to hang a flag. Like, can I do that? Or I want to do chalk art. Can I do that? And we were like, fuck yeah. Like, you're on the list. There was no selection committee. There was no negation. Like, anybody who wanted to do something was welcome to do so. And so facilitation is about care. It's about meeting people where they're at. And it's about connecting the people who have needs to the people who want to give. And I am by no means an expert in any of these fields, but it gives me a great joy to try and figure out those systems. And I welcome anyone's help who wants to help me figure out those systems.
Dulcinea, you are also an artist. You are also a filmmaker. You are also someone with a keen eye to aesthetics. So I'm curious, how has this physical place, this confluence of contradictions, how has it impacted you personally and artistically?
Well, Patrick just reminded me I should tell the story of how I wound up in Bombay Beach. So I actually came here before Tao, and not before you, like chronologically, but before I met you. I found my way to Bombay Beach, as many people do, and it was quite smelly at the time, and there were tons of dead fish. And I came as on a day trip with my friends, and I'll never forget, we were walking, we had like just gone up the stairs and we were walking down the beach, and my friend like had some beef jerky, and we were all eating the beef jerky, and like as we got closer and the smell got more intense, we were like, oh god, this is like the jerky and the fish, and it was very, very intense. And yet I was like, this is actually the craziest place I've ever been. I mean, it's like a movie set. You've just walked onto a science fiction movie set. There is nothing weirder in my life that I have ever seen. And also grew up, born and raised in California, had never heard of it until I was like 20. So immediately I was drawn to it. I wrote a script called Mecca, based in Bombay Beach, but sort of borrowing the name of the town right next door. And that was like the start of my journey with Bombay Beach, was trying to investigate the craziest place, the thing that I would imagine going to Mars feels like. And so, of course, as the universe works, I like got connected with Tao because of that script. I had given the script to a producer because at the time I was trying to make it and it was too expensive because it's all children and children make movies very expensive. But he read it and he knew Tao and he was like, you should talk to this guy. He does things in Bombay Beach. And so that's how I wound up here. I had heard about the Biennale. I had never been, but I'm a lover of all things festival, all things non-festival, all gatherings, all happenings. Living here, and I haven't even lived here that long. I mean, I've been on and off for the last few months and here semi-permanently for the last, I don't know, month and a half. Living here is quite a different story. It's very, very intense. It's isolating. It's a different kind of distraction than living in Los Angeles. I thought I was going to come and like have all this time and like think to myself and be alone kind of. And it was the exact opposite. Everyone knows where I live. Everyone knows the code to my door. I wake up in the morning and sometimes people are there in my house. They want to come. They want to like get stoned at 10 in the morning. They want to have a walk. They want to do a class. They want to do pottery. And I want to do all of these things. But doing work in this environment is like quite a task. And there is conflict and there's contrast. And then there's nowhere to go. Literally. And so it's very, and again, everyone knows where I live. So living here is like this beautiful, beautiful tension that I'm really eager to continue pushing through. Because there was a moment, I mean, I stormed into Tao's bus one morning and I was like, I have to get out of here. Like it was, I was like, I was feeling like really caged in. But now, of course, in retrospect, I want to continue pushing through that discomfort because there's an amazing quote that I'm probably going to butcher, but it's like in a society that strives to make you pursue comfort at every moment possible, it is a radical act to make yourself uncomfortable. And I think that living here for a long time, and that's why, I mean, I said this last night, but it's like I challenge all of you to come. Live here for a little while longer. Come for just more than a weekend because you'll start to experience the tension. And that, I think, is where the beauty of it is.
So, Dulcinea, I'm going to challenge you in an interesting way in this moment because it's actually around comfort and discomfort, which is the self-care of a festival producer. Now, it's not a festival, but it is a festival in that you are producing, facilitating, working a lot. You are where the buck stops for many things. A lot of people are going to you. What has your self-care been, and what can you commit to me in this moment your self-care will be moving forward? Yeah, in front of all of these people, so it's like community
boundaries.
Accountability. Yeah. Yeah, talk about boundaries.
Boundaries. My goal, I mean, really in life, but especially has been made clear to me in the past few weeks, is sometimes my energy is leaky. And sometimes I do not have an adequate force field to sort of confront other people's leaky energies. And because I have a big heart and I love the humans around me, I can sometimes open myself up to all of that leaky energy in a way that is destructive. Okay, so one of the most catastrophic things that happened in the last 2 weeks is my stove broke in my house. And I couldn't make coffee in the mornings because I didn't have a fucking electric coffee maker, boiler, water boiler. And so I had to leave my house at like 7 a.m. to go find someone who had coffee for me because I'm a coffee addict. And I realized that not having a morning to myself, having some silence in the mornings led to some deep mental and spiritual chaos that led me to storm into Tao's bus at 10 in the morning and be like, I have to get the fuck out of here. And I did go because I had to drop my dog off. And I went back to LA for 2 days and like really thought about this was like a week ago. And I thought about my leaky energy and how I need to take care of myself because this is a gargantuan task to take care of everyone else when they need things. And something very simple was like, okay, the Palazzo is getting locked down from 7 a.m. to 10 in the morning. Nobody is going to come in. This is my space. I'm going to be able to make my own coffee. And just that tiny bit of time, which I've also learned from filmmaking, like when you shoot a movie, you work for like 14 hours. And it's people, people when you're directing. It's people, people, people. And I found that if I can have an hour or two in the morning, usually it's at like 4 a.m. But if I can have those 2 hours, I can center and ground. And then I can sort of have a little bit of a boundary and be able to meet people where they're at. So boundaries.
So you've been very gracious in hosting me in your home. So I can help you tomorrow morning have a little.
It's okay.
Time.
Everything is lost now. But that's because the work has already been done okay. In a way. It's been done. Everyone's here and there are some questions to be answered, but it's the same thing in film. You set up the structures and then you let them run their course.
Well, maybe I'm challenging you to make a self-care commitment. Maybe we can facilitate some kind of like spa day for you next week. Maybe there's some kind of pass the hat around.
All I want is Alex's hands on my body.
Yeah, he's here. You know, Alex, our friend who's an extraordinary body
that
worker.
That sounded crazy, but he's a masseuse.
He's an exceptional body worker.
He's a body worker. And, masseur.
Yeah. So, okay. So let's support you having a little spa day, because that would be an important contradiction to this space.
Yes.
Get a lot of like steam and bath and water.
Yes.
Dulcinea, thank you so much for coming up here and sharing your experience.
Thank you. You facilitated beautifully.
So my podcast is Life is a Festival. And the goal of...
And ours is Being in the World, which we're going to co-release.
Yeah, we're co-releasing.
That's why I wanted you, Patrick, if you have a few minutes.
Okay, yeah, come on. All right. Okay, you're
my
still...
co-host, my reluctant co-host.
Okay.
It'll be you too, though.
Okay, no, sit down.
Patrick.
Hi.
Welcome to the hot seat.
Thank you.
I think it was hot where you were sitting before, so I...
It was, but, yeah. There's a thing they do now in cars. You actually have to lease the little seat warmer button. You know, it's actually a rental now. There's a subscription model for some new, like, 2022 cars. You don't get it. It's there. It exists. And I feel like I paid too much for the seat warming button right now because this thing is on fire. This is ridiculous.
Well, it's there's been a lot of energy in that seat. Okay, so you have already delivered a beautiful talk this morning, which I was preparing for this, so I was not able to attend. But there was a handled brain at this particular talk. And I think that this gives us a nice moment to talk about the fact that Bombay Beach is not only a art gathering, but it is also a philosophy conference. And I understand that you've been a part of that from the beginning. So for you, what actually is the value of a philosophy conference? What is even the point of getting together and talking in this way?
So I guess to me, there's something about the fact that there are discarded brains in the world. And what I mean by that is not brains that are turned off, that are kind of carried around and showed off. I mean, living ones. And what I find so interesting here, there's a kind of solipsistic beginning to this, which is it's actually really hard to sometimes imagine something before you've seen it. So, and I say that very like carefully and simply, which is to say, maybe Tao had heard about Bombay Beach before he came here, looked it up on the Salton Sea, saw it in a book. Dulcinea had also, I had also. And there's this common experience of imagining what, a kind of abandoned town by the sea might look like. But I don't know anybody who has not been like phenomenologically or perceptually like shocked when they actually first got here relative to what they had imagined. Because, of course, there's a limitation to what they had previously imagined because it had to be, by definition, based on something that they've experienced before. And it's just so odd, I think, the rapid contrast coming from L.A. Or the rapid contrast coming from one of the surrounding areas of California to here. Because it feels kind of, I mean, let's see, how do I make this not cliche? So I ended up having a similar experience to Dulcinea, where I ended up living here for a month last year, so around this time last year. And it was an interesting time because in part, it was pandemic. There was no, was there a vaccine yet? I forget. I don't think there was a vaccine yet. There's a sense in which what people had moved here for, and when I say people, I mean the kind of original inhabitants of this place, the people that moved here without art in mind, came here for isolation, right? In some sense. I'm sure they all have their own personal reasons. But it seems kind of obvious that this is a active and intentional stance against living in a city or living where there's a mayor or living where there's a police station. This is not that. And so what I found really interesting about being here for a month last year was that, you know, there was a kind of epidemiological need for isolation, which is what I was embracing. But I found myself in like cohort with other people that were seeking societal isolation. And it was just kind of a rare overlap that I hadn't really thought about or noticed. And yeah, like, so living here for a month, I mean, I came from downtown LA to here. There are a lot of like successive confusing emotions for me because I had moments where, like Dulcinea, where I was like, I need to get the fuck out. And I would just hop in my car and leave. And it was kind of like the equivalent of like dunking my face in cold water briefly, was getting out, just remembering that everything exists out there, and then coming back. I have this thing where if I'm ever on like a flight, if it's more than maybe 4 hours, at some point when I'm on that plane, I will think to myself, this is all I will ever do, and this is all I have ever done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, I'm on this plane, I have to get to know everybody here because we're stuck forever here.
Is there a word for that? Is that like a Bardo experience or?
I don't, yeah, I mean, I guess it is. Yeah, I'm kind of like one foot into the some afterlife I don't understand. What I realized only when I came here was that there are a lot of spatial configurations that can create that feeling for me, and Bombay was actually one of them. So it was actually really, really amazing. So usually it takes me about 6 months for something to feel like it's my home, because I go through that process of feeling like I'm trapped for a while and I have to understand its borders and boundaries and all these things. But I very, very quickly felt comfortable and at home here. And I think it's because of the small little square grid that you get. You're always aware of the cleanliness of the boundaries. Yeah. And that creates this, like, to me, comfort, where it's not civilization extending in all infinite directions. It's just you're either on A through F or 1 through 5. And so there's just something very simple about that. Imagine if we grew up as like primates swinging through the trees in the African savannah, and there were just like 25 trees and they all had, you know, like 5x5 grid. It would be so much easier and simpler. And I feel like that's one of the great comforts here.
So you yourself are a philosopher. I think it might be helpful for the audience listening in this moment to just locate us a little bit in your work. And then I also want to circle back to the question around the conference itself. And I'm going to give a little spin on it, which is, I was discussing with Tao the collision of art in this landscape. And so maybe you can touch a little bit on your relationship to philosophy and the collision of philosophy in this landscape, which I think you were alluding to just now. Maybe that could be woven a little bit into your own philosophical pursuits.
Yeah, I feel like I ended up using words as my means of expression in large part the same way that, like, when the Colorado River was dammed, the water ended up at the lowest point. Like, I just can't do anything else. Like, I don't know how to make anything. I don't know what light is.
I'm a podcaster, man. I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I end up speaking about things, and that being my only actual form of expression that seems to have any relevance or any impact on anyone else. Like, I've tried all the other ones and just nothing else works. And so I do actually think, in a certain sense, like, I actually disagree with the premise of your question, which is you're here making art, but then there's also this philosophy thing. How does that mix? And I would just say, well, you know, like, the voice box is a kind of physical instrument. You say some things and it does something to the listener's head. Now, in very reductionist terms, that's no different than some sort of musical or like a physical impingement on someone else's brain. So I see actually philosophy or any kind of speaking gig, hosting a podcast, what anyone does, it's, to me, it's a, from first principles, a kind of art. If you do it well, or if you do it intentionally, or if you do it with the same kind of approach that might.
Science?
Yeah. So
is a scientist also.
Does the same go for science? Is,
yeah,
Tao's question.
So, right. I actually kind of had a visceral surprise reaction when you said, so you're a philosopher, because I don't think ever identified as that. Like, I'm a neuroscientist. I had a degree in philosophy as an undergrad, but I only did that because I thought the only way to access brains was through words. And then I realized you just take them out and there's brains in jars. carry them around and you can stimulate them with electrodes. I didn't know we could do all that. And then once I did, I switched to neuroscience. And the thing I'm most interested in by far, easily, is why people have preferences for some things and not others. Like, I think you could fully define a personality by, like, moments of approach and avoidance behavior, like moments where they're either moved towards something or away from something. We have all kinds of analog words for this in every kind of relationship we can have between objects or between people. But ultimately, I see it as kind of an approach avoidance thing. And when I arrived here, the first thing that mattered to me is just, why did people come here? Why? They had a preference to come here. That must come from somewhere. And I kind of like tracing that chain back. My scientific work is in mind control parasites. So, like, to me, it's no different. So there's a little parasite that gets into mice and makes them not afraid of cats anymore, gets into mouse brains. So I was fascinated by, you have a brain, you have a mouse. The mouse wants to do its default thing. And then something comes in and changes it. And it changes it in a way that could arguably be good for the cat, because then the mouse gets eaten, or bad for the mouse, because then the mouse gets eaten. But so it's actually, like, up to interpretation. That moment of manipulation is up to interpretation. And so what I find really interesting about, first of all, this area is a kind of controlled condition where people came here. I'm also quite interested in, I see no difference between whether or not a tiny protozoan is in a brain changing someone's preferences or behavior, or whether it's an artistic experience they just had, whether or not it's a physical thing. Like, both, to me, those are both physical things that got in somehow. They either got in because you ate the wrong thing, in the parasite case, or they got in because you stood in front of a piece of art, or they got in because you closed your eyes and listened to a beautiful piece of music. In all three of those cases, something has gotten into your brain and changed who you are. And I see no fundamental difference across that. So to me, investigating like what is the impact of art on a community, to me, is still actually, I think you could frame it as just a question about what happens to a brain when it experiences something new.
What is the most peculiar and interesting thing that has gotten into your brain this weekend or over the past 3 months or however long you've been spending time here this time around? Or maybe I'll say a peculiar and interesting thing, because the most is a bit of a, puts a little bit of high stakes on it. What is a peculiar and interesting thing, non-hierarchical thing, that has wiggled into your consciousness and changed it?
My pause is a reflection on the quality of the question, not the my lack of answer. I'm thinking. So I don't know what deja vu is. And I don't know what it means to feel like something's familiar. But the thing, I mean, this is going to sound like ridiculously introverted and solipsistic, but like I've been mostly thinking about how weird my experience is to come back to a place after a year having lived there for a month. And I did do the Dulcinea wish where I kind of violently left in the middle of the night because I just had to leave. And that was, you know, that was a very harsh way to, it was almost like a surgical excision. And so I didn't say goodbye. I didn't slowly walk out with any kind of closure. And so I've had a very, very odd experience here, just subjectively, which I cannot convey, which is just, this place feels so infinitely familiar, but so infinitely far away to me. And I feel comfortable here. I know every street. I've walked every street. But that distance makes me actually feel really alienated here. And so for some weird reason, I think I've had like a very conflicted understanding of which emotion actually gets hierarchical precedent in my brain right now. Like I'm confused. There's like a rotating series of emotions, one of which is the deja vu, one of which is sadness and this failure of closure, all these things. And they kind of like peek through like the sun through the clouds, each at their successive moments, but there's no one dominant one. So it's just been a weird, just on the inside of my head, it's been weird.
Sounds like that could be nice.
I actually wouldn't call it nice.
Or perhaps entertaining.
Well, it feels like I'm trapped on a transatlantic flight on the inside of my head, and I've come to terms with the learned helplessness of capture, I guess.
Well, Patrick, thank you for bringing us into your mind in this peculiar way, because I feel like I have some version of that in different experiences in my life. And I think that this location does that deja vu thing, but this sort of like, almost like, I don't know if non-consensual deja vu is the right word, but it's sort of like deja vu that's intrusive deja vu, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's exactly.
Yeah, the space has an intrusive deja vu quality, almost like a nostalgia for something that is not good and hasn't happened yet versus a nostalgia for something that you love and wish to return to. I feel like in this place, there's glimpses of a sad future that through an artistic lens is imbued with meaning in a way that gives me strange comfort, but I still feel like really ill at ease. But for me, I like it. And I'm not sure why I like it. I think maybe because it's entertaining. And as Tao was talking about, like the Walmarts and the Denny's are so banal and bland and much far worse than this sort of like dystopian landscape where it feels like at least here something happened.
Yeah, there's a phrase, I believe it's outdated in psychiatry, kind of the second half of the last century, anticipatory nostalgia, which was actually, people would get diagnosed with this occasionally when doctors ran out of ideas. And it was the idea that like, even when something good happens to you, you are anticipating its end. Like even something is just amazing in the present. You're living your best life. You're having a fantastic experience, but you develop this melancholic kind of curtain that descends on you because you realize it's temporary and you have anticipatory nostalgia for the moment and you become afraid of its end. And yeah, there's something here that kind of creates that, which is, yeah, I don't know why. I can just say I don't know.
I have anticipatory nostalgia for the end of this podcast as it is coming just right along the horizon. So I'm going to thank you, Patrick, for coming up on stage and demand Tao's participation for 3 minutes more. Thank you so much, Patrick. Here's the thing, when we're talking about schedules and hierarchies, Tao has something that is referred to as a hard stop.
It's not really the hard stop.
The hard stop of consciousness. And that is in 3 minutes. Okay, Tao, so here's how I'd love to wrap our conversation today. I do a podcast, it's called Life is a Festival. The point being that if we can make our lives feel more like a festival, that can help us metabolize the difficulties and the vagaries and the ups and downs. Like there's something about, and it goes back to a kind of, who's the Pythagoras was talking about life as a festival back in the day, that a philosopher should live life like a festival, embracing impermanence and being present for the experience as a source of wisdom. And so these experiences like Bombay Beach Biennale are by their very nature, and part of why they're fabulous is because they end. We were talking about this anticipatory nostalgia. There's something
same
about
with life.
It's same with life, this impermanence, and the impermanence is beautiful. And part of how we deal with life, I think, is by embracing impermanence and by embracing some of the qualities that we experience in environments like this and bringing them into our daily lives. So the way that I'd love to finish our conversation today is for those who have been spending their time with us on this hot Saturday afternoon, or those who are stuck in traffic listening to this in audio form at this moment, can you give us some of your own techniques for living a life that is more like, I guess in this case, we must say it's a not festival, but living a life.
Well, if all of life is a festival, then this is a festival too. So,
okay, touche, touche. So if all, but what are some of the techniques that you use to bring a sense of immediacy and meaning and purpose and joy to your life that makes it feel more like these kind of peak experiences of art and gathering a community?
Well, we start out talking about Heidegger a little bit and being in the world, and he has this concept of being towards death, and that death, like the existence of death, is what makes any meaning possible whatsoever. Because if you had an infinite amount of time, there would be no reason, there would be no significance to making one choice over another, because the other choice would be available somewhere down the line. So instead, in contrast, we have this finitude, and that every choice represents the death of many other choices. And therefore that choice like attains significance. And so I think here we're especially presented with the ephemerality of anything that man-made or natural. There's a constant dying away. There's a temporariness of everything. And it's, we play with that because, you know, we try and tell artists like their work should be permanent, but only insofar as permanence is a possibility in this universe, which is not at all, and especially not here. So we also tell artists they have to take into consideration that 120 degree summer heat and 100 mile an hour winds and insects and vandalism and dogs and theft, and try to incorporate and embrace all of these things in your work. So it's this kind of struggle with the temporariness of everything. And that's what we're grappling with as artists and as philosophers and as neuroscientists. And we're all trying to figure out what the fuck is going on here in this little slice of time between the birth canal and the yawning grave, as Terence McKenna said. We have this little moment and we gotta just do what we can, right?
We got this little moment, and we got to do what we can. So, y'all, we got another couple of days of this culmination of the 3 months of Bombay Beach's art. What do you call it? It's not a Biennale anymore. What is 3 months?
It's still going to be the Biennale, but it's a season.
What does Biennale even mean? Twice
so
a year?
The name Once is a every joke. 2 years? Okay. It's every 2 years. But the Venice Biennale in Italy, where I'm from, is has the most kind of highfalutin art festival. So Bombay Beach Biennale had a nice alliteration and a kind of absurdity because, again, we're juxtaposing unexpected things.
All right.
So we do a Biennale every year, even though it means every other year.
All right. Well, We've got a little more contradiction to squeeze out of the next few days before we come back.
Thank
next
you, Amy.
Year. Tao, thank you
fun.
So much. Yeah, really appreciate great. It. Dulcinea, Patrick, and thank you everyone who is here today. Really appreciate you and see you out in the salty sea.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you liked the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.